Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
Do you want to spend more time in God's Word, but your tight schedule doesn't permit you to sit down with your Bible? Do you sometimes find the Bible confusing? Join me, Pastor Will Wheaton, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, a daily 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study with the church, past and present. You can listen and study anytime, anywhere, on your commute, at the gym, or while doing housework. Learn more at thewordendures.org, thewordendures.org.
Here is what we're hoping will happen. The virus will become more and more rare, infections more and more rare. We will open up the economy again and there won't be a rebound. Here's what we're fearing will happen. We'll go through all that, open up the economy and our society, and then there's a second wave of the virus. And then what do we do? Do we shut it down again? Do we isolate ourselves again as families in our homes from work? Is there a better but perhaps more difficult to sell way of dealing and opening up both during and after COVID-19? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to answer the question, how do we open during and after COVID-19? Lyman Stone, he's Chief Information Officer for Demographic Intelligence, Research Fellow with the Institute for Family Studies and Adjunct Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He and his wife serve as missionaries with the Lutheran Church Hong Kong Synod, and he's author of an op-ed for the Washington Post titled, "The Key Tool to Safe Opening is Not Social Distancing." Lyman, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
How have South Korea and Hong Kong, where you are at, been able to weather COVID-19 without a mandated shutdown?
Very simply, by using more stringent isolation of people who are or potentially are sick, by wearing masks, and by practicing social distancing very early. There's also more testing and aggressive tracing, but really the strategy is isolating close contacts of anyone who's sick very early on so that they don't go on to infect others.
Explain how contact isolation works.
Right, so it's pretty simple, right? So if you have COVID, you are contagious, usually from about anywhere from 2 to 4 days after your first infection until about 10 to 15 days after. That's sort of the peak contagious period. But in that period, a lot of people have very mild symptoms or even no symptoms, which means it's very difficult. If you just say, well, if you're sick, stay home, that doesn't really stop transmission very much because a lot of people are not going to feel sick at the period where they're most contagious. So instead, what we do here in Hong Kong or in what they do in Japan, what they've done in Korea, in Taiwan, in many places, is instead of just telling people who are sick to stay home, we identify people who might be sick. Anyone who is a close contact of a sick person, any recent arrival coming into the airport or coming over the land border with China or on a boat, of course, anyone who tests positive, anyone in their household. And what we do is instead of saying, oh, you know, you might be sick, please stay home. It'd be helpful for everyone if you just did the right thing and stayed home. We say, okay, you are now required to go into a safe, hygienic environment where we can observe, we can test you, we can check, are you sick? Are you a danger to others? If you're not sick, we'll let you go relatively quickly. But if you are sick, you'll then be held until you're no longer contagious. And of course, if you have serious symptoms, then you'd be rapidly transferred to a hospital. But this strategy works because it identifies a lot of people before they even know they're sick. Before they would even think to go get tested, we, as a precaution, isolate them, which reduces transmission by much more than home isolation or simply relying on testing.
Already here in the U.S., we are only beginning to see and realize the economic impact of shutdown orders and closing businesses and the like. What is, so far as we can tell, the economic impact of contact isolation?
So the nice thing about contact isolation is that if you have a large program, that is, you have a lot of people who are out tracing contacts, you have enough spaces to isolate all the impacted people, you have the right set of incentives in place to ensure that voluntary compliance is very high, so you don't really need to be doing a lot of enforcement. With the right set of arrangements of this policy, you can allow people to go to church. You can allow people to go to restaurants. You can allow people to go to the park. Here in Hong Kong, we went out to Outback for Mother's Day to take my wife out. We will be returning to church with very few or no restrictions. I forget if it's this Sunday or the next Sunday. And we've had sort of a reduced version of physical church presence for the duration. Our restaurants never closed. Our malls never closed. The economy here simply didn't shut down because it doesn't have to. Because as soon as someone is sick, we identify all of their contacts and we isolate them. That means that everyone else, everyone who's not a close contact of a sick person, can go about their life. Now, school is still canceled. People are working from home. People wear masks. I'm not saying life is totally normal, but it's more normal. It's not as disrupted. And this shows up if you look at like data on cell phones. We track people's cell phones. We say, okay, how many people left their house? How long did they spend outside of their house? And what shows up is that Hong Kong people have actually done less social distancing than anywhere in America. And yet, COVID is better handled here. Why? Contact isolation.
Has contact isolation prevented a second wave there in Hong Kong?
So we had our first wave in January and February, but it was very small. And contact isolation nipped it in the bud quite quickly. Then we had a second wave in March and into April, which was driven largely by imported cases. That is, Hong Kong residents coming back to Hong Kong from other countries. So we got a big wave of imported cases, but they did not infect very many locals. That is, the average number of people infected by these imported cases never rose very much above one, which if the average number of people infected by an infected person is below one, then the disease will eventually die out on its own, which is to say that these imported cases didn't lead to sort of a new epidemic spread. And the reason was contact isolation. Anybody who got off a plane was tested, and no matter what their test results were, positive, negative, they were fitted with a tracking bracelet, like a satellite tracking bracelet, and they couldn't leave their house. And then if they did have any symptoms, or if they were close to anyone who had any symptoms, they were put into an isolation facility. And the result was that we had this big wave of imports, but it didn't actually lead to a big wave of local cases. And even when we did have local cases, we have a website that the government runs that maps precisely every building that has an infected person who's slept there, visited there, eaten there, which means that every day I could wake up, I could check the map, and I could assess what is the risk of my plans for the day. If I'm going to go downtown, you know, what are areas I should avoid in my neighborhood? How cautious do I need to be? And there was a couple of weeks where we did have some local transmission in our neighborhood. And so we were much more cautious for those 2 weeks. But then when that stopped, we were able to rapidly resume normal life.
Does contact isolation require 100% or near 100% compliance or the use of law enforcement?
It does not. This is a common misconception. You talk about isolating people and they get in mind that like we're going to put people in concentration camps or something. And this is not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is getting hotel rooms and having people stay in them. We'll pay for their food. Ideally, we pay them a wage to replace their lost work time as well. Surveys suggest most people will voluntarily comply, especially if we pay them, that we're going to get very high compliance no matter what. But the point is that we don't actually need very high compliance. With no controls at all, the average person infected with COVID will infect somewhere around 1.5 to 3 people. In a natural environment, that's what will happen. We just need to get that number below one. So then if contact isolation reduces the average number of people infected by an isolated person by, say, 90%, then we really only need to isolate somewhere between 30, if natural would be about 1.5 infections per infected person, 30 to 60% of potential contacts. But the thing is, most spread of the disease is driven by super spreaders. It's driven not by each infected person infecting two people. Most infected people will infect no one, but a few infected people will infect like 100 other people. So if we can identify those people, we really only need to successfully isolate the most infectious, say, 20% or 30% of cases. If we can target those people, then we can effectively reduce the spread of the disease. And by the way, this is what Japan did as well. In Japan, they call it a cluster busting model. This is their term for it. But it's basically identifying and isolating super spreaders. So this strategy is tried out in many countries and is highly effective.
We're talking with Lyman Stone of the American Enterprise Institute and author of an op-ed for the Washington Post titled, "The key tool for safe opening is not social distancing." When we come back, many fear that contact isolation would lead to weeks in isolation for family, work, and home. We'll see how he responds next.
In sickness and in health, in these days of coronavirus panic, people are learning how difficult keeping this vow can be. The May issue of the Lutheran Witness looks at the wedding day. How does the couple plan their wedding with their pastor in a way that points to Christ, the only one by whom and through whom they can keep these impossible wedding vows? Read all about how Christ keeps his church in sickness and in health in the Lutheran Witness. Subscribe at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective.
The Substitute Organist Service, aptly abbreviated SOS, really has come to our rescue.
Pastor Jim Hollowatch of Christ Lutheran Church in Jackson, Mississippi.
With the ever-growing shortage of skilled musicians in our community, we were approaching a real crisis. But thanks to the Substitute Organist Service, help is always just minutes away. With its easy, intuitive interface, friendly customer service, and outstanding musicianship, you really couldn't ask for more.
You can find out more about the Substitute Organist Service at churchmusicsolutions.com.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Lutheran Federal Credit Union serves the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod community with car and personal loans, mortgages, credit cards, checking and savings accounts. Lutheran FCU supports LCMS organizations with its Spotlight Ministry program, and Lutheran Federal Credit Union allows you to make purchases with Apple Pay, Google Pay, and Samsung Pay using your digital wallet. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Good for you, good for the church, Lutheran Federal Credit Union, LutheranFCU.org.
Lutheran Talk.
We have an ecumenical responsibility to hold forth the scriptures and to bear witness to grace alone, faith alone, Christ alone.
Lutheran Music. Listen anytime, anywhere in 2020 with the Lutheran Public Radio mobile app. Download for iPhone, Android, and Kindle at issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. On this Friday, May the 21st, we're talking with Lyman Stone of the American Enterprise Institute and author of an op-ed for the Washington Post titled "The Key Tool for Safe Opening is Not Social Distancing." So, Lyman, many fear that contact isolation would lead to weeks in isolation from their family, from their work, from their home. How do you respond to that concern?
Well, the first thing I would say is that if a person really has a principled argument for why they don't want to be isolated, as I said, we don't need universal compliance. So we don't need to force them. Now, I think there should be a reasonable fine. Think of it like a speeding ticket for each day that you refuse to obey an isolation order. But we're not talking about the SWAT team busting down your door. So if you have a deep principled objection, you know, nobody's going to shoot you for resisting. But the second thing I would say is that most isolated people are not going to be in there for weeks and weeks and weeks, because most isolated people are probably not sick. They're going to go in, we're going to test them, they'll be out, probably in a week or less, depending on how quickly we can get them to the test and when we think they were infected and things like that. That is, the median person is not going to be there for a long time. Now, if someone tests positive, they might be there for a while. But newsflash, if you test positive, you don't want to go home to your family. You're going to infect your family. Now, if your kid tests positive, you probably want to be with them. And so I think that we should allow families to be isolated together. Obviously, we should never be separating families from their children. But if I tested positive, there's no way I'm going to go home to my four-month-old daughter. Why would I endanger my child like that? How am I going to feel if my daughter dies because I came home with COVID? So we shouldn't think of this as forcing people to be separated from their families. We should be thinking of this as empowering people to protect their families. And I should say, this is very real and pressing to me. We have some people that we care about, members of a Lutheran church in the U.S., who have multiple children in the hospital right now. The infections were spread essentially through the family. One member of the family got sick and spread to others. The family wanted to be able to go into separated isolation. They asked for this, but the state that they live in couldn't provide it to them. And so now multiple members of the family are on life support, essentially. This is a nightmare scenario for families. I cannot imagine the fear of knowing as a parent that I am a lethal danger to my children. So we don't want to separate families, but we do want to give families the option if they want to protect their kids. But crucially, what we're doing is we're giving people a chance to protect their families, protect their community, and ultimately reduce the burden on community by allowing everyone else to return to something like normal life.
Someone says that contact isolation sounds like a violation of individual privacy and liberties with the tracking, with the limiting of movement, things like that. How do you respond?
Well, right now we're limiting the liberties of 100% of society with lockdowns. Contact isolation is a way that we can come out of lockdown, and not just come out of legal lockdown. We can come out of informal lockdown. We can feel safe together again. The virus inhibits our liberty. It creates fear. It doesn't matter what the law says. As long as there's a lethal virus spreading, your liberty is limited by nature. By nature, red in tooth and claw, by a disease. You are threatened by this fallen nature that is attacking you. So I would say that that is a threat to liberty. So if we want to have society return to its freedom of movement, freedom of association, that means beating the disease. And the fastest, most effective, and least restrictive way to beat the disease is with contact isolation. Yes, for a small share of the population, it will inhibit their liberty. That is true. But dying in the hospital also inhibits your liberty.
If you had a few minutes with American political leaders, the president or the governors of the states here in the U.S., how would you urge them to adopt contact isolation rather than blanket shutdowns?
I'd say the first step is that we need really good manuals on how to run a contact isolation program put out by the CDC. They need to write a practical how-to guide for municipal governments, county governments, state governments to run these programs. Then the next step is for some governments to actually do it. Book up hotels, train the workers, and have nurses be doing symptom checks, digital symptom checks, right? Have people take their temperature and send a picture and things like this. Just start doing it. It's not that hard. It's not that complicated. We should just do it. And I should say, right now, cases in the U.S. are declining. And it looks like this summer we're going to see a return to normal. In a lot of ways, not total normal, but life is going to return to something like normal this summer. That's great. But that happened during the 1918 pandemic as well. In fact, deaths right now are perfectly tracking the 1918 flu pandemic. They bump up a little bit in the spring, they fall during the summer, and then the worry is, will they come back in the winter with a vengeance? If we allow low-level transmission to continue during the summer, that means there's a lot of potential patient zeros in the winter. And that means when the winter comes, we could see a massive wave of new cases. So we need this summer to be rolling out contact isolation programs so that while cases naturally are declining, we crush them to zero. We need to crush this disease during the summer. It can be done. It has been done in many countries. And there's no reason the U.S. can't do it, too.
How would you respond to someone who is against contact isolation, and their fear is simply that their loved ones would die alone?
I understand that fear. an astonishing number of deaths have occurred of elders at home in their house. What I would say is that the number of people who are going to die alone and we discover their bodies later is much greater without contact isolation, because you'll have more spread of the disease. Other strategies are less effective. More people will get sick, and more, especially elders, will die alone. Now, if your worry is your child is going to die alone, I have some news for you. You're going to put your child in the hospital when he or she gets sick. And when your child is in the hospital, the doctors are not going to let you be with your child, because your child is highly contagious. Here's the reality of COVID. You die alone. If you die of COVID, you die alone, either in a hospital because you are in isolation because you are a severe case and they don't want you to infect others, or an elder at home alone. There is no dying together with COVID, not in our system. If hospitals were overwhelmed and we couldn't fit people in the hospitals, then you might have a situation where you might die together with family members at your house. But American hospitals are not overwhelmed. American hospitals are mostly empty right now. We have plenty of hospital space. So the reality is, if you die of COVID, you're going to die alone. That's terrifying, but it's reality. We just need to deal with it.
What kind of response have you gotten so far to your Washington Post op-ed?
It's been mixed. Some people think it's great, but a lot of people think that the disease is simply not serious enough to merit new responses. They think when lockdown's end, that should be it. I worry about that. I think it's possible that that will be it. I hope for that. I pray for that. But I think it's very possible that that won't be the end of things, that we will have an autumn resurgence. When that occurs, I don't want to cancel the economy again. I don't want to cancel society again. Frankly, I don't want to cancel church again. I just want to have contact isolation. Just put a few people in isolation and deal with it so the rest of society can continue as normal. So I think the main response I've heard is people who just, they're so emotionally committed, they're so emotionally exhausted, they're so emotionally ready to be done, they're not thinking rationally about past experience of major epidemics, they're not thinking rationally about the odds of resurgence, and they're not preparing for a reoccurrence. So I want to be prepared for the next wave. That means rolling out contact isolation programs now while there's a real chance that we can crush the disease during this summer.
Finally then, Lyman, we've heard about a security law being considered or imposed in Hong Kong. Give us an update on the political situation there.
So there's been protests in Hong Kong for quite a while against the communist government seizing more direct control of Hong Kong. And the communist government is apparently upset about these protests. And so rather than try to pass stricter legislation through Hong Kong's legislature, which is the normal way that this would happen, and the way that constitutionally they're sort of required to do it, they're using a debatable loophole to basically pass tons of legislation through China's central authorities to impose on Hong Kong from the outside. This is probably not constitutional under Hong Kong's constitution, and it's a huge threat. It means that China's agents can operate with impunity within Hong Kong, arresting, kidnapping, deporting, removing people who they regard as being guilty of sedition or treason. It's a huge threat for missionaries based in Hong Kong who may operate within China and see Hong Kong as a safe place. It's a huge threat for freedom of speech in Hong Kong. Frankly, it's a huge threat to the viability of business and journalism in Hong Kong. It's very likely to be the death knell of Hong Kong society as we know it.
Lyman Stone is Chief Information Officer for Demographic Intelligence. He's a research fellow with the Institute for Family Studies and adjunct fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He and his wife serve as missionaries with the Lutheran Church Hong Kong Synod, and he's author of an op-ed for the Washington Post titled "The Key Tool to Safe Opening is Not Social Distancing." You can read it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Lyman, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
In hour two of Issues Etc. on this Friday afternoon, Dr. Kevin Golden will join us. We're going to remember the Queen of Persia in the Old Testament, one of them, named Esther. She gets her own book of the Bible. Then it's This Week in Pop Christianity. Rich Wilkerson has preached a sermon on the 12 spies in the Old Testament book of Numbers. Pastor Chris Roseborough will evaluate it for us then.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.